Good evening. Welcome to the Spring 2017 Green Living Seminar Series at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. This annual lecture series is funded by the MCLA's Academic Affairs, the Environmental Studies Department, and donors to the MCLA Foundation. Each spring semester, we invite a series of experts to campus to present on various aspects of sustainability and the environment. This semester, our series topic is the science and management of invasive species. Over the course of the semester, we will welcome to MCLA various experts from state and federal agencies, academia, nonprofits, and private industry. Each week, our guest speaker will delve into their area of expertise related to the research and management of invasive species in our state, region, as well as globally. Information and links to audio and video recordings of tonight's lecture will be posted at mcla.edu/greenliving. I want to highlight the talk for next week, with Speaker Joe Roman, who will speak about eating invasive species. And at the conclusion of our lecture next week, we will have various food samples of invasive species provided by and prepared by Chef Greg Roach. And then our series will conclude on April 27th with a lecture by Ken Gooch speaking on forest health of Massachusetts. Tonight's presentation will last around 45 minutes, and then we will have about 10 minutes for questions and answers. Tonight's speaker is Dr. Nita Talent, the Chief of Natural Resource Management and Science for Cape Cod National Seashore. Nita was born in Arkansas and grew up around the world in Saudi Arabia, Germany, and Austria before her family settled in New Hampshire. She earned a PhD at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, College of Life Sciences, where her focus was on the impacts of non-native plants on New Zealand floodplains. Before joining the Department of Interior in 2010, Nita was a research scientist with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Prior to her arrival at Cape Cod National Seashore in 2016, Nita served as the program manager for the National Park Service Mojave Desert Network Inventory and Monitoring Program in Boulder City, Nevada. While there, she led a team of natural resource scientists and professionals in the inventory and monitoring of natural resources at the 9 national park units that comprise the Mojave Desert Network. Nita's 20-plus year career as a field ecologist has provided her with a wide range of experience in the applied science and ecology of floodplain ecosystems, forest, high-elevation montane rangelands, and deserts. Nita lives on the Cape and Wellfleet and enjoys exploring the communities, history, and natural resources of the Outer and Lower Cape. Please help me welcome Dr. Talent to the Berkshires and to MCLA.
Thank you, Daniel. I feel so special. I just drove in from the Cape, and I have not been to this part of the state, so I'm very excited to be here. So thanks for that invitation. Before I start this conversation, and I'd like it to be a conversation about invasive species, I just want to give you a little background. The 9 parks that I supported are Mojave Desert, so Death Valley, Joshua Tree, Lake Meads, Great Basin, Mojave Preserve, an assortment of others. And then I came to Cape Cod, and I have the question of how can I work in one system and then come all the way to an aquatic system or a marine system? Because many of the science issues that natural resource professionals are dealing with are very similar despite the landscapes. And one of them that's really on our agenda are invasive plants and animals. So I was thrilled to be invited to come today. And again, it's a dialogue. It might be a little different than your other presentations, so if you have a question and you want to engage, that's fine. Because I brought probably far too many slides and just getting out of here in 45 minutes, which I'm starting the timer now. Okay. So I'm going to be talking about several things tonight. One of them is the objectives and the definitions, because if you haven't learned anything yet in this seminar, there's about maybe 25 to 35 different expressions or words used to define an invasive and non-native. I'm going to be talking about invasive species management at the federal, the Department of Interior, at the national park level. I'm going to talk a little bit about Cape Cod National Seashore. Who's been to the Cape? Come on. Good. As a kid and as an adult. Good. It is a magical place, but it's an interesting place as well. Species and habitats at the park, and then some contemplations and considerations and changing our mindset or refocusing about invasives. So I'm just going to be using the reference to non-native and native species, whether it's a plant, an animal, any microorganism that's introduced outside of its native range into a novel non-native location via human action. Lots of words, but you're going to find that the definition of a non-invasive species has tripped up more of the policy and the legality of them than anything else. So for the sake of tonight's talk, we're talking about something that's non-native and native species that have escaped and have been introduced outside of their native range. And so it's invasive, it's widespread, it's abundant, and has an ecological or economical harm to it. So there's a lot of words in here. But if we don't start looking at some unifying languages, this issue is going to just keep getting bigger and bigger without any solutions. This was taken from a text, Invasive Biology, and it's in reference to all the terms that were found in publications that used to describe invasive and non-invasive species, and just going through everything from weed, that other meanings, to rural, all the way up to adventive, foreign. Some of them are very political. Some of them are offensive. We, for a while, were using exotic, and suddenly that became inappropriate. So you can tell the error when something became viable was by how they referred to invasives. So the other thing I want you to be thinking about is, where did it come from? How did it get there? It's intentional. Most of our invasives have been from agriculture, from forage, from game species, from, now I'm seeing the flash, the environmental enhancement. What do you think environmental enhancement is? Come on, be creative. You love words. Environmental enhancement. We have gardens. We want our landscapes to look like we want them to. So we start adding things to them or taking things away from them. Go to Japan. Everything is terraced. Horticultural species, pets, biocontrol, conservation and scientific research. All of those have been the sources of invasives. There's the unintentional ballast. You have to be able to be buoyant. You bring water around the world. You release it. It's only full of gazillion organisms that are now at some place that they shouldn't have been. Fill, meaning developmental fill, sand, rock. Hitchhikers, the brown tree snake, how it was introduced to Guam is as a hitchhiker inside planes. So it's not deliberate at all, but it's now there. Packing material. A very sad statement about our history is many of our invasive grasses came on slave ships from Africa. That was the only source of bedding, was grasses, hay, and they would put it as bedding, and then when the slave ships would get to Georgia, North Carolina, Florida, they would be have to clean out, muck out the ship, and with it went the grasses brought from Africa. And you can trace the path of slaves being sold with invasive grasses. So transport. This is what I was most interested in New Zealand, is we have this passion, this eco-psychology, this love for our landscapes. And plants, just like animals and birds, don't stay in one place. And it's the psychology is when I show a group this picture, I've talked at garden clubs, there's oohs and ahs, and oh, it's so pretty, and I want to get the hummingbird feeder out there. But when I say all of these are invasive, at some point, someplace, no. We're only talking about kudzu. That's bad. So I want you to be thinking today about the psychology of why is one plant okay and not another plant, or one animal's okay and not another plant, another animal, an organism? Because we are dealing with that issue of these charismatic species that some people like and some people don't. So what? Why are we having this class? Because you want to get a grade. Why am I here? Because I wanted to see North Adams. I've never been here before, and it's very flattering to be invited, so that's why. But why are we talking about invasives today? Land managers have limited resources. I heard someone say something about our current administration, and I know it's not a secret, but there's, you know, money. There's a projection. EPA is going to have a 31% cut in their budget. Park Service probably will have a 17% budget cut. Not confirmed yet. We're hoping it's not true. Limited resources. Less people to do more work. 100 million acres of federal lands are infested with invasive species at present. Thousands of non-native plants. And what that is, why that's so such an obstacle is we don't really know what all these organisms do, plants, animals. We assume. We make generalizations. We think if one thing is bad, then the other thing may be bad, but maybe not. I did my graduate work in New Zealand, and I enjoyed it because they have a very pragmatic attitude about invasives. 85% of the plants that you see when you go to New Zealand as a tourist have been introduced since the 1830s. That's it. It's a country that doesn't, two islands that have no natural mammals, but yet now most of their landscape has been ravished by the mammals that have been added. All the way from the goats from Captain Cook to the stoats that were brought in to get rid of the possums. You thought that was a children's book. It really did happen. So they don't have the resources or the capacity to get rid of the invasives. They have a very practical attitude. And the attitude is, we want to know exactly what it does. And I wish the U.S. would have a much more of that attitude. Instead of just saying it's invasive and let's do something about it, to figure out how benign is it? And under climate change scenarios, how benign, what do we expect it to do? Establishment of non-native species is a primary factor in species endangerment and land use change. So I'm going to talk at the federal level. The federal level is that in the 1990s, when you were all little wee people out there, there was a letter from about 500 scientists. And what it was about was that plants, animals don't stay within political boundaries. And trying to work within the political system was very difficult because as soon as you get from here to there, you'd have to stop. That's not my jurisdiction. You work for Park Service. I work for Forest Service. We can't work together. And we weren't doing things the same way. We would be out there with our little clippers and our volunteers, junior rangers, and Forest Service would be out there with their spray backpacks. And there had to be some consistency in managing. And so instead of fighting over resources that we didn't have, there was a mass effort to combine, to inspire at the Clinton administration to do an executive order in which establishing a council that invasive plants invasive plant management would become an overarching. The goal was to have consistency for us to be able to work together. And so in doing that, there was Executive Order 13112. And if you stay in invasive biology, you'll know about Executive Order 13112. It was issued in 1999, and it established a council to work across jurisdictions. Now Park Service could work with BLM, or Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service. We could work internationally. Great Lakes is a great example of that. If you can't work internationally, you can't work on invasive fish and organisms in the Great Lakes. We were also working with Mexico, and it was an incredible effort. Not perfect. It's quite complicated. But out of it came the executive order and the committee. And this committee, it was their decision to provide leadership, one constant. We also wanted to work on having international cooperation. We wanted to bring states and tribes into it. We wanted to look at the ecosystem level. And each agency had to have a national invasive management plan that fed into the plan. It was a very ambitious effort and a great start. One of the last orders that Obama put together was the Executive Order 13751, which was signed in 2016. Has yet to be rescinded. We'll see what happens. Safeguarding the nation from the impacts of invasive species. So this built from, we had a committee. We had people talking to each other, but we didn't have it really outlined what we could do. And so what this allowed for was to expand membership. More groups wanted to become part of it. And we also wanted to talk about incorporating human health, environmental health, climate change, and tech and innovations. This is for next semester, perhaps. Big, big emphasis on bringing tech. How do we fight invasive species? How do we deal with them? Let's bring private sector in. Let's start talking about innovations. So what was started was expanding our toolbox as managers, but also our war chest. How do we fight them? So if you're staying in this field, these are the things that you would need to know. Because you can't do anything in the government unless you have a law or an executive order that allows you to do this. So this is my thought. Invasives, are they good? Are they bad? Are they benign? Who really cares? If you were alive when this movie was out, that was fantastic. And so I've thought of four topics in which I range. It's the ecological impact. We all know the ecological impact of kudzu on a landscape in the southeast. You know, there's different attitudes about seeing pollution on the side of the road. When you're in the southeast, kudzu, you can't see the trash there. So there's a positive. So this is a definite ecological impact, encroaching on native species, decimating habitat. No one has an argument with that. The economic impact, and I took this slide from many of the presentations that I've been part of, and just looking at the economic loss and benefits from invasives in the Great Lakes, and these are the loss. So we can argue that. The economics. Economics is the way to go. I grimaced when he said ecosystem services because it's monetarizing a lot of things that we like to think we can't monetarize, but you have to monetarize them because then the public listens. And then the other one is it ubiquitous? Is it entrenched? Is it something? I just don't know what I'm doing here, Nate. Okay, so is it out there? So this is cheatgrass. And it's in the West. That's how the West is now. 100 years ago, it wasn't there. It was brought in seed. And it's there. We're not going to get rid of it. It enhances, it increases fuel load. It causes more fires. It actually encourages shrub growth instead of having open spaces. But it's there. For us to get rid of the millions and millions of acres, we're not going to be able to do it. Is it logical for us to have resources going into it when we know it's going to be there? And the final one is public perception. This is the Cape. Isn't that pretty? That's beautiful. Your granny would love that for Christmas. You try to talk to your granny about getting rid of that? Oh, that's the best thing about the Cape. The roses. That is an invasive rose. That rose is a horticultural escapee, and it's also dune stabilization. But we're not going to get rid of it. People, one, it just takes too much effort, and it's going to keep back. And people are starting to say, what real impact does it have? So those are the things I think about with invasives. Is it ecological, economical, ubiquitous? Is it so entrenched in public perception? Here's New Zealand. Isn't that pretty? That's on every postcard of Mount Cook. There was a equivalent to a park ranger at Mount Cook, and he said, boy, I need to add something to the landscape. He got seeds for Russell lupines, and that's why they're these beautiful. These are not supposed to be in New Zealand at all. But when you talk to people that have visited New Zealand and gone to Mount Cook, they will tell you they love the flowers. And they've got pictures and calendars of it, and they even got even calendars of lupins of New Zealand. They're not native, and they change the soil chemistry because they're nitrogen fixers. And now we've just completely changed succession in this community. But you try to talk to people about getting rid of it, they're not happy. So I don't know what I'm doing. So when I was in New Zealand, I was working with another species, Buddleia Davidii, also known as butterfly bush. And this was brought over by the English. It's an Asian species. It's spread through all Commonwealth countries. And so the great thing about the British Empire is it spread all through the world. And so did all the English gardens, because they love to bring their gardens, because eco-psychology, they love, we all like to be surrounded by the things that are familiar to us. Our landscapes have to look like, we want to move somewhere else, but we want it to look like home. So they brought their gardens, and then during World War II, this plant was the only thing that could grow on bomb scars. So you imagine, your house has been ravaged, the Blitz has gone through, everything's dead, and the only thing that's going to grow on those bomb scars and piles of debris are Buddleia Davidii, and it just happens to have this beautiful flower, and it's so fragrant. It's so much so that when they try to remove it out of gardens now in the UK, there's big up, and people start arguing, no way, you can't take our butterfly bush. Just talking about that. So now we're going to transition to the Park Service. 428 units. If you want to see me get frustrated and angry and have a fit, say there's only 54 parks. There are 428 parks. Don't listen to anyone that says they're 54. I just had to get that out. So each one of these parks has a requirement to address invasive species through the executive orders. So we have to adhere to that. We are participants on the committees. We join in and do unified and consistent efforts. And we defined our invasives or our non-natives as species that occupy or could occupy a park lands directly and indirectly as a result of deliberate or accidental human activity. If you think that's confusing, it's the government. But what we're talking about are exotics, non-natives, invasives, weeds, pests, naturalized species, natives that have expanded beyond their range. We're really talking about something that causes economic or ecological damage. Very difficult. And what came of it is the exotic pest management team. You've seen hotshots out there fighting fires. Well, this came from the same model. We want to have these roving plant guys out there, and women, sorry, I'm not trying to be gender specific. Plant people out there, a strike force of plant management specialists to assist the park in controlling. And what they do is cut and burn and use pesticides. Because that was the tools in their tool chest at the time. They don't go out and look at the species and say, what impact does it have? They just cut and burn and remove. And it's the big ones. The concern right now is climate change is going to change expansion ranges for all species, including us. We're going to be moving to places we never thought we would. And in that, we're going to be either contracting or opening up habitat, and we need to be thinking about what's the impact of that. We use best management practice, where we're using integrated pest management, which means we try to minimize risk to humans and environment, but we do a multiple things. Biological controls, introducing bugs, cultural controls, mechanical, and chemical. For an example for a biocontrol is purple loosestrife. It's an invasive in wetlands. You might have heard about it already in your talk. It's ubiquitous throughout the wetlands areas. It was introduced in the United States and Canada in the 1800s. And people love it, but at the same time, it forms dense stands that prohibit native species. It was found in some of our kettle ponds in the Cape, and the decision was to use a biocontrol. And I am not even going to try to pronounce that. You'll figure out that I don't pronounce Latin words. Galuracella species was used. It had been tested throughout Mass. And we were one of the test sites. And fortunately, we have a reduction in plants as a result of the pest being introduced. The biocontrol being introduced. It's a beetle that's from Europe that is a natural prohibitive in Europe, and so it works well here. Our concern right now is the climate change, as temperatures increase, humidity, droughts, how will that change the effectiveness? Because, as you know, it's only 90%. So we still have sites that have purple loosestrife. It's just that we can keep them tamped down. So an example of biocontrol. Here's another way of having a person control, bittersweet, using a mechanical method. And this is the favorite one of most people. Just burn it. And that's what they do. This is burning Phragmites. So Cape Cod, real fast. I bet you didn't know a lot of things I'm going to tell you. So Cape Cod is here. I live there. Anyone that's been on the Cape knows that. We really do use that. We're like, hey, I live here. You want to go here to Provincetown? You want to go to Orleans? No, let's go to Hyannis. So it's the best place to live if you don't like maps. So the Cape Cod National Seashore is all of this green land that goes from here. And it's a tremendous amount, and it's a gem because it doesn't look like the Jersey Shore. It looks like a natural beach without shops. Timeline, it was decided in the 1930s to the 50s that they wanted to put a park in, and the war came along, and any park was just, there was no idea of adding parks until after World War II, and then 1950s. But it's the first national park that was predominantly lands that had been bought from owners. And it took from 1961. Anyone know what president signed it in? He had a great wife. Everyone knows Jackie. Thanks. Good. Well, I just out there, you know, the longer time passes, we got to keep remembering these incredible people. So, yes, John F. Kennedy, as a senator with Senator Siltenthal, decided that they didn't want the Cape to become the Jersey Shore. So they made a massive effort to have all the outer Cape, outer lands, Atlantic-facing beach, become national seashore, as well as the uplands. The Cape Cod model was that there'd be prior to the 1950s, Park Service units, would just be federal lands. This was public land, a private and public land that was bought. Six towns were incorporated into the seashore boundary. And so there's about 44,000 acres. Why I'm bringing this up to you, why should you care, is because all of these towns have houses, and all of these houses had gardens, and all these gardens had plants that spread out. And they had, it made it a very complicated part to do land management on because we were contending with what was the land use history. Other important thing to learn tonight is land use history. Anything you want to do as a natural resource professional, if that's your choice, you've got to know what's happened before to be able to predict or think about what's going to happen next. So these are the towns. Provincetown has the most of their town is in the park. Very complicated. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the resources there in case you haven't been there, or when you were there, you were only at, where's the beach, Paula? So if you, we have woodlands. The majority of the park is woodlands. It's a mixed oak. It's conifer. We're worried about southern pine beetle, so if you're talking about pests, and grasslands, and it's about 54% of the seashore. The beaches are the part that we love best, 24%. Freshwater ecosystems, so kettle ponds, these are a relic or a remnant of the glaciation period. These are where blocks of ice melted, and they're just incredible. If you haven't been kayaking on the kettle ponds, you're missing something. And tidal waters, we have estuaries, salt marshes, and nearshore waters. So it's a very diverse park. And within that park, we have instances of invasives. Some of them are agricultural, horticultural, and benign. They don't really do much. The big one that we have, and I'm going to go through these quickly because you've probably already heard about them, and we can talk about them if you want. But these are the dirty dozen or so that show up throughout the Mass and East Coast. Phragmites, though, is the one that we are contending with because we don't want Phragmites to move into our kettle ponds, and that's the most susceptible landscape for them. They're tall perennial grass. They invade wetlands and marshes. They're very salt tolerant, and they can be also have impacts of trapping sediments and reducing flow. A theme here is you've got to know what the impact is. So if you haven't, you're a natural resource professional. You're saying, what am I going to do about this? Ask more like, what is it doing to your landscape? What is it doing to your community? What economic burden is it putting on? What impact is it going to have? And that will help you better appreciate what you need to do. I just am trying to get away from just saying, oh, it's on a list. We got to get it out of here. Got to think about what's the problem with it? And so right now what we do is cut it seasonally. If you cut it at certain times, it's more effective. You burn it. Once again, burning is fun for some people. Water management, you start to manipulate the water level, and then you use pesticides. So here's another one, Oriental Bittersweet. This is the common theme is here is it's been introduced. It's a horticultural species. People love it. Birds love it because it has berries. Birds fly around, they defecate, and they spread it very well. But they also, it's vegetatively grown. And so you're going to see here the same story over and over again. Kind of boring. So this is what we do. Because we don't really have other effective ways to get rid of it. We have interns and AmeriCorps go out for a year, have a great summer at the, a year at the seashore, and this is what they do every day, is cut and burn. We have this other spotted knapweed. This is ubiquitous throughout the U.S., but it is a big problem. It's been spread through roadside stabilization seeding. And now it's now aggressive throughout our wetlands areas, and we didn't learn enough because we heard about it in the West, and some of us that lived in the West said, oh, when this gets to the East, people are going to be really upset. They're really upset. You didn't learn? We don't even talk to those people in California most of the time. It's a common theme. Most of what we have here spreads rather quickly. It spreads in people's cars. It spreads in wheels. It spreads in your boots. Go backpack in the Sierras, come back here, and you've brought cheatgrass with you probably. We also have Japanese honeysuckle theme that's here, is that these vines take over. They encroach on habitat, and they burst by birds. And the honeysuckles hybridize, and the same story. Beautiful berries, it's spread by birds. But as I'm talking about these less and less influence, so the number one we're concerned about right now is Phragmites, because it gets into our marshes, our wetlands. It has the potential to get into our freshwater ponds. Water quality is something we're all caring about. And now we're starting to get into more inland woodland species. And Japanese knotweed, same thing. It escapes from gardens. We shouldn't have any gardens. That's it. Gardens are bad. Okay, somebody's awake out there. So Black Locust was planted. It was imported because it was good railroad ties. It was good railroad stabilization. It's a nitrogen fixer. What is nitrogen? Who knows? What does nitrogen fixers do to the soil? It's an easy. Come on. Try. It adds nitrogen to the soil. What do you add nitrogen to the soil when you want a green lawn? Yes. So we add nitrogen to the soil through the black locust. And now the soil is more fertile and all these other grasses and things are like, oh my gosh, this is a party. I am so hungry. I'm going to eat. And that's what happened. So you have trees that add nitrogen to the soil. Now we fertilize the soil and we have more invasives as a result. But it's naturalized. That means it's already in the forest. It's in the woods. You can find out if you're out hiking in Cape Cod and you come across black locust, you can pretty much be certain that used to be a homestead, a house, a small town, because once they're there. We do find that they have decades of influence. So in 1990s, there was a big storm. It was a hurricane, 1992. Hurricane Bob came through, knocked down a whole lot of locusts. Researchers went back 20 years later, and they still found the nitrogen levels where the locust was is higher than surrounding landscape. So it's a long-term effect. Some people says, who cares? Well, once again, that story, it's changing the successional trajectory. It's changing the landscape. What are we going to do? Multiflora rose, everybody loves it. It's beautiful. It's fantastic. But it's an invasive, and it will take over. It was introduced as rootstock in the 1860s and continued as a hedge species. And now it's just there, and there's nothing we can, you know, really nothing. When I say nothing to do about it, we could do some very dramatic, you know, slash, burn, pesticides, biocontrol. Do we really have the resources to do that? What is it doing? These are the questions you as the future natural resource professionals have to ask yourself. When you're mandated, you only have $30,000 budget. Do you spend it on getting rid of something that's not ever going to really go away? I don't have the answer. So we also have the maple species. People love to bring their trees with them. Now, these are getting lower and lower in priority because we find them in the forest. They do change the forest landscape, but they're not spreading radically right now. What happens with climate change? We don't know. What are they going to do? We don't know. But we really don't have the resources to go out and selectively cut all the maple out of the hardwood forest. Autumn olive, that's having more of an influence. Birds love it. We have all the privets. Privets were introduced as hedgerow species. They're throughout Europe. People love hedgerows. You don't have to put a fence up. And they spread because of these berries. The birds love them. Displacement, birds will go for these berries, spread them throughout. And a cypress spurge. So this was introduced as an ornamental in the 1800s, and it's very toxic. I'm going to not spend a lot of time on the marine invasive species because I am not a marine biologist. I took these slides, and I will admit to you, last night at 11 o'clock, I was Googling, what the heck is this thing? So if you know more about this than I do, that's fantastic. But I want to make the impression that it's not just plants. I'm a plant ecologist. That's why I like plants. So I was in birds, but you've got to get up early in the morning to do birding. I couldn't get anyone to help me, and I didn't want to get up, so now I do plants. So sometimes we make choices about our academic path not based on anything intellectual. That's a lesson. If you don't like doing something in the field and you want to be a field ecologist, don't study it. Just go to something else. I've had people like, I don't like snow, but I want to go and do snow coring. Okay, think about this. So the European green crab is invasive. But the European green crab is one of those invasives that kind of gets our heads all mixed up. How does it get us all mixed up? Is because Sarsena, the green crab, has helped restore marshland. So if we get rid of the green crab, we're going to have degraded marshland. It's because the native crab depletes the marshland grasses. Now, for centuries, the native crab was kept in check by fish and other crabs. And then there was mass fisheries, and people came in and depleted the fisheries. So now we have the native crab that's going, oh my gosh, this is the most delicious and wonderful place to live. and it burrows and it tears apart the marshes, and there's not much we can do about it. But then started noticing where the green crab was, there was not as many of the native crabs, and so it filled the void that was left by the decline of the native predators when they went into decline. And so now we have this dilemma. What do you do? You know, we got a mandate. We got to get rid of every invasive out there. But this isn't an easy story. So fortunately, we're not tasked with getting rid of every green crab. But that is the stories that we have to be thinking about in the future of invasive ecology is, do you really have to, you know, get rid of everything? Think about functional biology. What is the void or the gap being left? There's a paper about this there. I just put it in, if anyone's interested in that story. And then I'm going to go through these quickly because they're intertidal and they're also marine species that have an impact. And the biggest thing many of them do is they either outcompete the native or they become a food source for another species that leaves the void, or they colonize in large mass. So we have crabs, we have sea squirts that just cover everything. Here's on oyster bags. So what's, anyone know what Wellfleet is famous for? Wellfleet is famous for its oysters. Well, you talk about a pest in Wellfleet that affects the oyster beds, and you get people really excited. And so when these organisms start moving in, that's the issue we have. And we have tunicates that they affect the eelgrass and the seagrasses. They look like they wouldn't be popular. They just look like things that you would go, ugh. And golden stark tunicate. We have the compound sea squirt. And on. They form these mats. They outcompete other species. They clog up. They get onto structures. Some of them are large. Some are very small. And so we'll go through these. But these all have been found in Cape Cod Natural Seashore waters. And we have been people mistake this for seaweed. It's all throughout the beaches. This, the green sea fingers. And it adheres to the bottom side of docks. Just going through these quickly because, again, this is not my area of expertise. And rather than try to fake it, I'm just going to be honest with you. But I want to instill in you that invasive ecology also includes pests. Whether it's the pest, the southern pine beetle that's moving in. And then these are the others that I point out because they're on the Cape, they're in the seashore, but rainbow trout is stocked by the state. So we're like, oh, can't do anything about that one because that's revenue. We can't get rid of those fish because people buy fishing license. And I'm being snarky, but I mean, you've got to think about these things. Economics does weigh into environmental decisions. We can't be naive any longer. You can't isolate yourself. Take a class in economics and environmental economics if you're going to stay in this field. You have to appreciate it. Brown-tailed moth as well as gypsy moths are pests that impact our trees. There aren't really many pesticides that can take care of them or get rid of them. They do have an impact. They're changing forest composition. Ring-tailed pheasants. We hunt, Cape Cod National Seashore has hunting. You can go hunting up there and you can hunt pheasant, you can hunt turkey. There's turkeys. I saw turkeys on the beach the other day. It was a riot. They're like drunk turkeys. They're trying to run on the dunes. It's a riot. But they're native. Sorta. They came from somewhere. They moved from New York and New Jersey. Everyone from New York and New Jersey on the Cape. So, ring-tailed pheasants are hunted, so, we're going to keep adding them. Why not? Asian carp, big fish with big mouths that have been pretty much removed because we opened some of the dikes that allowed for now flow of seawater back into Pilgrim Lake. And then the red fox, I put a question mark there because depending on who you talk to, some say it's native, some say it's not. I could not find any consistent reference, but I know people that like piping plovers hate red fox. And if you hate something, suddenly it's a predator becomes very bad. And so maybe that's why. Drivers of change. Climate change. We, whatever we want to call it, it's having an impact already on the Cape. We have coastal erosion, sea level rise, precipitation, drought, and then we have the others, the land use modification that we are dealing with. All of these are disturbances that lead to invasives. So instead of us targeting our invasive species, we target our critical habitats, the places we find so special, the places that are locally abundant but rare. So our grasslands and heathlands are very popular, beaches, our eelgrass beds, our salt marshes. This is the result of the crab and the kettle ponds. So we don't always target the species itself. We target the landscape. We're doing restoration efforts, and we want to be very cautious about how we do restoration of previously dammed sites. So we don't want to allow invasives to come in as we're releasing water. We also have this fantastic bike path. People like the bike path. Have you been on the bike path? It's so popular. It's the leading place where people get hurt at the seashore. But it is. They don't get hurt. No sharks. It's bicycles, crazy bicycles. But it's also a corridor for invasives because people love to go from Bourne, and they bring things with them, and it gets in their spokes and their helmets. That's how it gets spread. So accepting your naturalized species, that's what my campaign is. Embrace your naturalized species. Love your Rosa rugosa. You know, the beach rose. We accept that it's there. It's not going to be removed. Typha. That's cattails. It's there. Our grasses, lawn grasses get spread. It's ubiquitous. Dame's rocket, Scotch broom. They're all there. So embracing that. So the themes that we have tonight, and 7:45. Feel good. I thought I wasn't going to make it. I hate being kicked out of a room. So the themes, though, that I would like questions or discussion about, talk to each other. Text each other while you're talking. But think about, I've just described a system that has been inhabited for many 300 years. It has gardens. It has agriculture. It has invasive plants. We can't control them. We can manage some of our landscape. Should we be putting all our resources to say that we're invasive free? Or should we just start to rethink it? And so I don't know what the previous topic, but I wanted to be later in the talking points of this session, of this 12-week series, so to get some of this input, because I'd like to know what people think about that. So thank you very much. I know somebody's got to start the question. Good.
So could that beetle that you're using to take out the purple loosestrife, is there any plan in place in case that ends up becoming an invasive?
It's a long process to get to being a biocontrol. And in general, the expectation and what has happened more currently is that the plants actually develop more resistance and the beetle fades out. So that's happened with salt cedar, it's happened with loosestrife. And we don't see the population anymore. Because that was done in the early 2000s. And every once in a while, they're trapping. It's a big issue. It's a complicated issue. It's a bit, it goes out for public comment. It takes a long time to get approval. And part of it is just demonstrating that it only can live on the species that it's targeting and that it has a benign influence. But yes, your concern is legitimate. In the back. Good, I saw you.
You're talking about naturalization of non-native species over a period of time. Is there a measure for how, I wouldn't say damaging, but how much you're willing to lose in the natural ecosystem for it to then become stable and naturalized?
Yes, there's within the science of invasive ecology, which is an interdisciplinary field. It's one that is now specializing in different areas. And impact analysis and risk assessment is a big area. And so what you're describing is looking at, there's several formulas that can be approached. One is looking at overall how much of the resources is affected. What's the economics? And is another component of that. And so if it's a species that's found in forests, and it has especially on plantation forests, that would have a huge economic, or if it's a horticultural forest, then it would have an economic impact. And so you start to look at how widespread, how abundant, and the impacts. What we don't understand are the impacts. We don't really put as much research into looking at the overall influence that an invasive will have. And part of that is a little bit of academic bias against applied science. And it's like, oh, do I really want to sit around and study Buddleia Davidii in New Zealand for 4 years? Oh my gosh, that sounds awful. But people really don't, we need to have more people that are interested in what's going to do. What is it? How's it going to change the landscape? Looking at it at different scales. It's spread out, or is it very isolated? So, there are some formula, there are some processes that you can use to make those decisions, but we need to know much more about it to make informed, because we don't know what's going to happen once the climate really does, and on the Cape, it's happening now because sea level's rising, we're losing beaches, we have houses that are going, you know. And so, if that's an area of interest of yours, you probably do well with it. Oh, good.
Yeah, so I'm wondering how far you want to go with embracing the naturalized species, and what will we give up? Would we, in terms of native species, or are you maybe even suggesting, or one application of this idea would be a new sort of community mapping where here's purple loosestrife monoculture community, and maybe 100 years from now we're protecting that as a unique community or something that today we're... What's the end game of...
These are the questions we need to be talking about. We need to be opening up to these questions. Right now there's an area of ecology called novel ecosystems, or the ecology of novel ecosystems. I studied for my master's, I looked at novel ecosystems as a result of dams on the Colorado River, and how it was created. And some of I am getting to the answer to your question, but some of the issues that we had to deal with is by creating these new landscapes or these new areas because of dams, we were bringing in, habitat for threatened and endangered birds. So you create a dam, you've ruined a lot of landscape. I'm not going to deny that, but suddenly now we have protected birds nesting in the invasives, the salt cedar, and we're stuck. We have a dilemma. Who do we honor now? The willow flycatcher is protected. It's federally protected. But it lives in an invasive, and it's a result of a unnatural process, a dam. All dams are unnatural processes. So that's, it's a discussion. It's not an easy answer. No more than when you have your next class on endangered species and you talk about the value of the snail darter versus the charismatic polar bear, which gets preference. You have to talk about how far do we go with this? We just have to, and I think we evolve with why I love teaching and engaging is because you're going to be asking these questions in 30, 40 years to your students of the same way, saying, well, what should we do about this? Should we be taking species into space with us? Should we be doing these things? And there isn't an easy answer. When I ask, so I just been at the seashore 10 months. And so I, as a chief, kind of cool, gee. But I go in and I say, why do we let Montiflora rose or rose of a beach rose stay here? It really doesn't do anything. I mean, that just made me crazy. It's like, what do you mean it doesn't do anything? Haven't we read about it? Haven't we studied? Don't we look at this stuff? And they're going, it's been here for 40 years. It's just on certain dunes. It's in certain places. People love it. Do we really want to? And so that was that informal sort of the culture, the... It was so in New Zealand, I would go out to these creeks, and I would look for a butterfly bush, and it was affecting the hydrology of the system. And I would say, oh, my gosh, it's beautiful, but it's having a negative impact. And so I started going and looking at people's gardens, and I found it in their gardens. And then I found out that someone's granny had been passing out cuttings for the past 20 years and asking people to plant it in the creeks because it was so pretty. And so now I'm fighting. I've suddenly become this graduate student that is out to get rid of all the butterfly bush. Americans aren't that popular abroad. And to take away their butterfly bush even made it a little worse. But, so it's it's public. We can't do it without engagement, public engagement. We have to have, the rules have to be flexible enough that they, I worked with Native American tribes in Arizona for a while because I was trying to come up with decision models. How do they make decisions that have no economic benefit? How do they embrace and they look at ancestral and current cultural? And that's the same thing as thinking, looking, engaging in that conversation. What do we want our landscapes to look like? And your proposal. Do we want to have monocultures? Do we want to be able to say, over here we're just going to have certain species because economically we can't handle it, but we're going to protect these biomes over here. We're going to protect parks. And that's what wilderness is supposed to be about. So it's not a, a hard question and a harder one to answer. Well, thank you.